Hi, this is Joe Siddle, and you are watching The Walk-Off with Scott and Adam.
Baseball, Blue Jays, and more baseball. It's The Walk-Off with Scott Belford and Adam Mack.
This ball is crushed.
The Die Hard podcast for the casual fan. Wire.
And another one. My goodness.
So excited to be joined by today's guest, former Major League catcher for the Montreal Expos, Florida Marlins, Detroit Tigers, as well as one of the hosts of Blue Jays Central on Sportsnet, Joe Siddle. Welcome to The Walk-Off, my man. Thanks so much for taking the time.
Well, thank you very much. It is cold where I am in Windsor, Ontario, but I'm not complaining one bit because I know it's even colder where you are.
Yeah, we are in central Alberta and have dealt with our fair share of the cold this year. By the way, Joe, before we even get too much into this, I did want to say that you and Jamie, always a joy to watch on Blue Jays Central. I truly love your baseball smarts and your insight, and I can't wait for you to be back behind that broadcast booth in 2022, hopefully in a timely fashion.
Well, I'll speak for Jamie too. We can't wait either. We love what we do. We talk about baseball for a living. It's a dream come true. I hope that comes out on your television screen that we love what we do. I think, you know, working with Jamie is easy as pie. I mean, he is just such a pro at what he does. I follow his lead. He probably says the opposite, that he follows my lead, but he does make life very easy. And, you know, without getting into too much, I've been very fortunate getting into this business. This is not something I dreamed of doing after being a player, but I've done radio with Jerry Howarth. I've done TV with Buck Martinez, and now I'm sitting alongside Jamie Campbell, all veterans in the business that certainly know a thing or two. And I've been groomed by some very good ones.
Well, it is cool, and you brought up that you hope that it comes across that you enjoyed, and it really does. And that, I mean, we do have a bunch of listener questions for you, so we will get to that. But we had probably over a dozen folks ask or even just mention what a big deal it was to see you show some emotion at the end of the season when the Jays were finally eliminated, and of course in the worst way possible, needing to sit around and watch the Nationals blow it. And it's always tough for players. It's tough on the fans. And it meant a lot, I guess, just to see you visibly upset. Were you expecting to be that choked up? And even more so, were you surprised to see how the outpouring of support when you were?
First and foremost, that was not the plan. I am a person that does cry, whether it's, you know, close people that pass, you know, we just lost my father-in-law recently, those things. It's not that I take them so hard. It's that when I verbalize something, if I'm talking on the phone to call somebody to say yes, so you know, my father-in-law passed away yesterday, I get choked up. Like it doesn't come out without me cracking up a little bit. It's not something I'm proud of. I try to control it, but that day, I will tell you this. And now, are we emotionally invested in this team? Well, yeah, we cover it every day. That doesn't mean we're super fans. And, you know, as you guys have seen, I'm the first one that's critical of things that the Blue Jays do when things aren't the way I think they should go, whether it's the manager or the lineup or something a player does. So I have to be very objective and play both sides. Now, it just so happened that I think it was this Friday or the Saturday. So it was either the day before or 2 days before that final day of the season. I caught Bo Bichette running out onto the field. We're at the Rogers Center, and we're usually down there for batting practice. And Bo's running out of the dugout, and I just kind of gave it a token. Hey, Bo, how are we doing today? And he stopped in his tracks, paused, came over to me, and he said, you want the truth, Joe? I'm gassed. And he kind of, it was like an admitted, like, wow, this has been a long 162 and he's battling. And we had heard Charlie talking about it. We had heard a lot of people talking about the grind for these young kids the first time. And it's true. And I haven't done that grind with the major league playoffs and all, but it is a grind. And I knew where he was coming from, but I think it really hit me because my response to him was, well, boy, you've been to the playoffs. Remember the big season they had in AA? You've played a long minor league season, postseason, the whole bit. He said, yeah, but you know, Joe, when you're in the minor leagues and you've been there, that when the playoffs come around, it's almost like you'd rather be home, like you had already gone home. And I was like, yeah, I remember those memories, getting to the playoffs in the postseason. And it's like, sure, well, let's go try to win. But at the same time, it's like, it doesn't mean anything in the minor leagues. So it really hit home to me that, wow, you know what, all these things you've been hearing, and I didn't want to use those on the broadcast too much as excuses for these players or for this team. But it really hit home. I think maybe it was resonating with me as a player, what these guys have been through, this three cities, the bouncing around, not having fans. It was brutal. But yeah, maybe, and I'm not making excuses, but I guess it all just came about at one time. And as I was describing the season, I started to lose it. I'm like, geez, like I didn't want to do that. I'm not going to lie to you. It was a little embarrassing. But yes, the outpouring of comments and support, I was kind of like, oh my God, I thought this was going to be like, who is this idiot on the broadcast breaking up because the team doesn't make the postseason? But so not something I was proud of. It went over okay, but no, I don't want to do that again. I probably will because I can't help it, but I don't know. It wasn't something I was proud of, but we got over it.
Well, in a time with social media where something like that could go viral and you be made fun of and all this, like literally every single person that we have talked to is like, Joe Siddall is now my hero. Like all of us were wiping tears away, and to see you do it, like, I guess it validated all us hardcore fans who were doing the same thing.
Well, and I think too, because the season was over and the way it ended, and you were watching, I'm sure, that day, we had people around our set in the Rogers Center down the left field line. They were 6 and 8 deep. We had all four screens up on our wall. We had the out of town games going on, and people were cheering everything and booing other things. And the Blue Jays kind of had things in hand early. So as we were watching these games, of course, the Yankees walked it off late. So everybody just, whew, that was not good. Okay, but now we got the other game on, and then it went the wrong way. And when it ended, I think it was just after the Blue Jays game ended, so they put the game up on the Jumbotron in the Rogers Center. So there were shots, if you remember, of Vladdy in the dugout, just dejected. When that game ended, it just happened so fast. And not only did it happen fast, but I think the realization came very fast that it's over. The season's over. So we just had this highly emotional day, a lot of rah-rah. Fans were crazy. It was wonderful. It was wonderful in the country, let alone just on our set at the Rogers Center. Mm-hmm. And it came to an end so fast. And again, I think talking about it, that's where I was trying to encapsulate the season. But I was probably encapsulating this long season in what just happened in the last 20 minutes.
For sure. I mean, it was crazy to watch. Like, I know for me, what made it so difficult was that the hope was so high for that brief 30 minutes where they won that game and the Red Sox were losing. And I was like, oh my God, could this happen? And then boom, it's gone.
And it's what could have been too, right? We know all you got to get to, you just have to get to the playoffs in the postseason in Major League Baseball. The Atlanta Braves proved that. You don't have to be the best team in baseball. Just get there. And then it's like a new season starting. And the Blue Jays had a team that could have made a run, I think. I think most people would agree with that.
Agreed. So it has been a dark time for baseball news. And yesterday we had some actual baseball news for the first time in what felt like forever. The Hall of Fame inductees being announced, and the baseball writers kind of putting in their two cents, I guess you can say, and deciding who goes where. And it was really shocking to me to see David Ortiz get in, first ballot Hall of Famer, but then Barry Bonds and even Roger Clemens denied. Really curious your opinion on this, Joe, because, I mean, both guys during their career tested positive for PEDs. So if we're going to say it's a steroid thing as to why somebody doesn't get in, Ortiz is a question mark. Despite that, Barry Bonds had, like, the greatest numbers ever. Where are your thoughts on this?
My thoughts are that I would like to see the best players to ever play the game in the Hall of Fame, because that's what I think the Hall of Fame is for. Now, can there be asterisks? Absolutely. Can there be stories that go with it? Absolutely. Because for me, it's the Hall of Fame and Museum. And that is a place where you read about the history of the game. So if I were to walk into the Hall of Fame and read about Barry Bonds, the Hall of Famer, the steroid story will follow, and Roger Clemens and Ortiz and all these others. Mm-hmm. It would be really hard for me to induct or vote for, say an Alex Rodriguez admitted to using steroids, all the checkered past he's had. That'd be really hard. But at the same time, we just don't have concrete proof on a lot of people. There are guys in the Hall of Fame right now that I'm sure we'd all agree have used steroids, but we just don't have that concrete proof. There's so much gray area. And that's why we've had wars, we've had steroids, we've had gambling, if you want to talk about Pete Rose, we've had racism, we've had awful people. And I think where I get really hung up is when you read the mission of the Hall of Fame and inducting and talk about character and integrity, because quite frankly, this game has lacked some character and integrity over the last number of years, right? So, I mean, I just think that has to go. Measure these players for who they are on the field. And for me, that Hall of Fame and Museum should be full of the best players to ever play the game. And Bonds and Clemens certainly fit that bill.
It is interesting how they don't wish to tell the full story. They would rather leave somebody out than just get into what happened, right? It's odd to think that they're erasing the steroid era in such a weird way, you know, like they're not erasing it. So why not just accept the fact that that's what it is and let the best players in? It's weird.
And I think when you say accept it, yes, accept it, because it happened. It happened.
Yes.
It's part of this game's history. So was when Bud Selig was the commissioner of baseball overlooking the steroid era. So was Bud Selig when he was, I believe, owning the Milwaukee Brewers at the time of all of the collusion going down. Like, let's talk about the economics of the game, too. If I visit the Hall of Fame, I want to go visit the best players that ever played, and I want to learn about the history of the game, and hopefully all of that is there. And I don't think that's the case.
Very well communicated, and appreciate your insight on that. So, Joe, we recently here on the show had Hagen Danner. He, of course, played with the Vancouver Canadiens last year, high-A affiliate of the Toronto Blue Jays. He was just recently added to the 40-man roster, which was very exciting for him, and we asked him about what it was like to finally see some real progress, right? You work so hard as a minor leaguer to get to the point where you're on the verge of that major league debut, and then of course he's got to deal with the lockout, so he's not allowed to see the facilities, he's not allowed to talk to the coaches. And I know we asked him about what his feelings were on that, and he was really beside himself, right? He was very disappointed. He didn't know really what to do or how to advance, and we asked him what the minor league season's going to be like, and he's like, I don't know, like right now I'm not even allowed to talk to anybody. And I know you kind of had a similar experience in 1993 with the Expos, where you kind of made your major league debut. You get some games under your belt, and then the 94 strike happens, the season ends. What is it like from a player's perspective who maybe doesn't have that cemented everyday spot with a team for their momentum to be paused like this? And I'm sure it just feels like you're going backwards, and it's got to be mentally tough on these kids. What's your opinion on that?
You're talking to the right guy when it comes to that, because yeah, I was the backup type player, and you know, I was fortunate to get to the big leagues a few times because I could catch. I was a good defensive catcher. I couldn't hit, but I got called up for my defense. Felipe Alou was with the Expos for my first major league call up. But going back to that 93 season, I got called up. I spent the last couple of months in the big leagues with Montreal. 94, I'm in spring training and get sent down. I go to AAA, hoping and assuming I'd get up to the big leagues that season. The strike hits in August. So it was devastating for everyone. So no baseball. Well, then 95 spring training comes around. Now you talk about that 40-man roster and non-roster. I'm a non-roster guy. So I'm in minor league spring training in 95. And remember the old replacement players things that the owners tried to pull. So it was so bad that we were in spring training, and then the Expos trained in Lantana, Florida. It was at a Santa Lucia's High School in Lake Worth, Lantana area. About a 15-minute ride from West Palm Beach, where they shared a stadium with the Atlanta Braves for big league camp. So we're at minor league camp, and you've got all these people and all this stuff's happening now. Well, they were absolutely threatening us to go and play as replacement players. And then they were baiting us to do so, because they were saying, here's a chunk of money to go over, and then you'll get another chunk of money if you make the team, and they're going to go on with replacement players and play baseball. And I just remember, this is just like brutal. This number one, we were kind of pawns, because you're a non-roster guy. I had just played in the big leagues in 93, but you're thinking you're a pawn because they're telling you have to do this, like, or else. And I'm thinking, or else what? So you don't want to get released. Of course you want to continue to play professional baseball. I would just be happy going down to AAA and playing in the minor leagues, but no, they were saying you had to go over. So it got to a point, and of course, a lot of guys are talking, and we're saying, what do you do? What do you do? And I remember speaking, and to this day, forever to this day, is going to be Felipe Alou, has been a mentor of mine. And he was my manager in 1990 in the Florida State League. And that's probably where I really made my mark, because as a defensive catcher, he loved me. Well, wouldn't you know it, in 93, he's the big league manager. And I got called up in 1993 because he liked what I did behind the plate. So I'm forever grateful for that. But he was in spring training down the minor league camp there. And I remember a couple of us, we pulled him over, and I said to him, I said, Skip, what do you think? Like, this is what's going on. This is what they're saying. This is what they're doing. His suggestion to me, I was asking his advice, and his suggestion to me, quite literally, he said, this shit's not going to go on forever. It's going to pass, and baseball is going to be back. Now, remember, this is a guy, now I was just in the big league. So I was just part of that union for over a couple of months the previous season. So it was really difficult because then you also go to our minor league hotel. We had John Franco, Bobby Bonilla, Tom Glavine. These guys would come to our hotel and speak to us at night. And I remember being irate because here are these multi-millionaires coming to say, don't you do this, don't you do this, do it this way, do it this way. And I'm kind of thinking, oh, easy for you to say. Like, I mean, here I was up in the big leagues, now I'm off the roster. And Felipe's point hit home to me because I agreed, like, this isn't going to last. Just like this work stoppage right now. We can bark every day. Who said what? Who? Mm-hmm. It'll end. Who knows when it'll end, but there's going to be baseball again and life's going to get on. So prepare for that. And that was his advice to me from Felipe. And I took it. So I said, that's it, not playing. So we kind of had to pack our bags and leave camp. And I said, so what? So I just did it. But it was difficult because we were really caught. And I think especially for me, you know, for the guys that I was in the minor leagues with that maybe hadn't got to the big leagues yet, hadn't gotten on a 40-man roster yet, it was a little easier for them because they're kind of thinking, I'm on the brink of my career here. Why don't I just go and make some cash fast? And a lot of guys did. And for that, so be it. But don't do that if you think you're going to want to play in the big leagues later. And we know it did happen to some guys, but that's just not the decision I wanted to make. So getting all the way back to when you referred to Hagan Banner, I think you have to be selfish sometimes. And I hate that because I don't feel like it's part of my personality, but you have to look out for yourself. And when you now, if you're Danner on a 40-man roster, you can't be in contact with the team, you have to control your own future and your own destiny. And the way you do that is you have your own personal trainers. You find the best there is. You, whatever it is, you find the facility, you get your work in. Because if this thing ends February 10th and you got to report to big league camp February 15th, you better be ready. And I know that's the, you know, the idea is the reporting date, or let's say it gets settled February 20th and they say, you be here. Don't be sitting at home while they're negotiating, be ready to play. So I say, take that in your own, be accountable for yourself like that. And you do what you need to do to get ready.
I love that. And it's a good point. So, and I know you touched on this a little bit here, so we'll get into this. We've watched Major League Baseball pitching just change drastically over the last 10 years. Just shorter outings, a bigger stable of guys, fewer pitchers are being thrown. And this really does, in my opinion, affect catchers because they tend to take more time to develop than most position players do. And it's because you touched on this, how defensively intensive that position can be. And I bring this up because the Blue Jays organization has a lot of depth when it comes to young, talented catchers. Everyone's super excited about Gabriel Moreno, right? There was all sorts of fanfare for Alejandro Kirk. But my opinion is that maybe it's Danny Jansen with 4 years of big league experience already under his belt, ready to make that next step. What are your thoughts on the Jays catchers? How patient should we fans be with them? And in your opinion, how long does it take to become a good everyday major league catcher?
Well, it takes a long time, or you have to be really good. And that's that, you know, where Danny Jansen is right now, he's the leader in the clubhouse because he's been around. Do I think he's the answer back there? Not necessarily. And I've said that on some shows. Like, he certainly struggled with the bat. There's no question. Now, can you hide a bat like that in the bottom of the Blue Jays lineup that's so potent? Absolutely. If he was a gold glove, star-studded guy behind the plate, very difficult to evaluate. And that's why those are the things, to me, I kind of evaluate by watching with my own eyes. I don't want to get on websites and look at framing metrics and all this nonsense. I want to watch the guy receive pitches. I want to watch him block balls in the dirt. More importantly, I want to watch him call a game and handle the pitching staff and see what his pitch sequencing is like, because those are the things to me that make you a very valuable asset back there. And I'm not going to say you have to have that to get to the playoffs and to make a run, but take a look around the postseason. If you go over all the teams and look who they had behind the plate, I remember doing it during the postseason because I was tweeting about it a little bit. Mm-hmm. And it was, you know, Travis d'Arnaud and Yasmani Grandal. I mean, the list went on and on. I won't even get going, but most of the guys were not younger, inexperienced type guys.
Seasoned vets. Absolutely.
Right. Now that's nothing, not to take anything away from Danny Jansen, but there were several times, and I've talked about it on many shows, where I questioned his pitch sequencing, his calling of how they handled a particular at bat or how they attacked a certain hitter and different things like that. So I would say subjectively, me watching, I had a lot of questions in that regard. My understanding is the Blue Jays love him back there. That's fine. But would I like to see a more veteran type guy? Yes, because now is the time. We're not developing anymore. Mm-hmm. Now, the flip side of that is you could say to me, well, maybe he's the one that's developing. And that's true, too. Maybe Danny's continuing to develop. And now he's ready to hit his stride because he's not in his first year in the big leagues anymore. Starting to gain a little bit more experience. He's handled a lot of pitchers. But until I start seeing what I think are better pitch sequences and how they're handling hitters, that I'm going to have those question marks. Now, it's easy to second guess that stuff. Very easy, because it's quite like, I don't want to come in my fourth inning update or my eighth inning update, and because the guy hit a home run, say you threw the wrong pitch. Like, that's not fair. In fact, I'll come on sometimes to say, I loved what he did right here. Tough, like he didn't execute the pitch. So, you know, it's easy to be the Monday morning quarterback and to say things hindsight 2020. So I don't like to do that. I really like to truly look at a situation, how I saw it as it was happening. And I'm going to be honest with you, and I'll tell you whether I was right or wrong. You know, when I talked about it before we came on air, or Jamie and I came to our update. So those are the things that behind the plate are questionable. I've heard tremendous things about this Gabriel Moreno, and we've heard he's going to be a great one, but I really put the air brakes on when I hear talks like that, because I'm like, let's wait and see. There have been a lot of players that have been really, really good in the minor leagues. Yeah. Guess what? That league up there, it's called MLB. That's another level. And, you know, I've heard a lot of fanfare around Alejandro Kirk, and he's done a nice job. He's handled his own. But there's some warts there. I mean, there are some things that he's going to have to clean up if he's going to be a major league contributor. He can hit. I think one thing I'll say, right, he can hit. And I think he will hit. But again, we'll see. You can't just take that and assume. I mean, when you see guys in the minor leagues that, you know, walk as much as they strike out, or that those, there are certain numbers that you can look at. They think that should translate. But let's not forget, you get to the big leagues, it's an entirely different animal. I've played with so many guys that were, you know, 2-3 hitter in my AAA lineup. Get called up to the big leagues, you're hitting 6th, 7th, maybe 8th. And it can be a struggle. It happens to a lot of guys. And then you have the kind of can't miss guys like Vladdy and Bo, these guys that transition no problem. But there aren't many of those. Those don't happen a whole lot. And until I see these guys with my own eyes, it's hard for me to see them in the minor leagues, but at the major league level, because it's an entirely different league.
Do you think game calling is the one skill that takes the longest to develop? Like, is that why we see guys like Travis d'Arnaud, who is just kind of kicked around forever, all of a sudden be one of the top guys because he's just been around long enough? He knows what to call when?
Yeah, that's exactly the point. Experience takes years. Now, I was very fortunate. I'll tell you a story about my own experience, and that I think that's what made me good in that area. I'll tell myself that's what I did. That's the only reason I got to the big leagues, guys. So let's talk about it. So I was in the minor leagues with the Expos when I came up, and Rick Williams was our pitching coordinator, son of Dick Williams. And he, to this day, I am grateful to him, Felipe, I mentioned earlier, but Rick taught me how to call a game because he was the pitching coordinator. And you think, why catcher, pitcher? Well, because you spend a lot of time with those guys. And when I'm down at an instruction league and I come in after an inning, we play those games, and he sits next to me, and I remember, I better have an answer for every question he has. And the questions are like, why'd you go 1-1 changeup to the second hitter last inning? I'm like, I can't remember last pitch, let alone. But he forced you to be cognizant of everything you do. How are you sequencing? When you're calling this pitch, you're thinking, okay, if it goes this way, I'm going to come back with this. If it doesn't, I might come back with that. You're planning. You can't plan the at bat necessarily, because you do handle your strengths, your pitcher's strengths and weaknesses against the hitter's strengths and weaknesses. But at the same time, sometimes things happen in at bats that change that. Or sometimes a guy's not swinging the bat the same way he was 2 weeks ago when you saw him. So many variables. And all of that, all of the variables and all of the things that go into that takes time. And it took me years in the minor leagues, because each year you gain knowledge. Okay. You have to adapt, and you have to know where to zig when zagging. And that's experience. And to me, when you go through the minor leagues for many years, you learn so much. And that's why I was best equipped when I got to the major leagues to call a game and to handle myself behind the plate, because defensively, physically, I felt I could catch with anybody. But then with this part right here, you need to know all of your pitchers. And that means getting with your starting pitcher and going over all the hitters before the game. But you also have to be with all your relievers, know what their best pitch is, their second best pitch. What are you going to get beat with when the game's on the line, or not get beat with? Our rule was you don't get beat with your second best pitch. So if you got a guy that's 99 with a slider that it's good, but it backs up sometimes, it's a little inconsistent, don't get beat with that. When it's crunch time and it's 2-2 in the eighth inning, you got to hit my heater. If it's Jordan Romano throwing 99, for example, that sort of thing. So those are the things that you learn, or I learned over so many years that I got to the big leagues. Now, hey, when you get to the big leagues again, it was another level for me. So, you know, the nerves kick in, you got to try to bring it down a notch and really slow the game down. It's very difficult. But now if I were to spend 2 and 3 and 4 and 5 years in the major leagues, that to me, those are the most valuable guys behind the plate, because they can handle any situation. They can adapt. They can read bats, read swings, and adapt within an at-bat. Those are the things that help your pitcher, because ultimately the pitcher has the ball in his hand. He's going to throw what he wants to throw. But if you can gain his trust, and that's where I felt was strength of my game, then you put the fingers down and they throw it. And rarely do they shake you off. And when they do shake you off, you call a curveball and you shake shot, you go, no, we're coming back with this. No, yes, we are. And if you really disagree, I remember having to go out to the mound, and that's, you know, now we have a limit on mound visits. But those are the things, though, when you gain that trust of your pitchers, they love you back there. Love the way you receive, love the way you call the game. And they love the fact that they know you are putting all of your efforts, both your mind and physically, into what they're doing to make them successful. Because that's what you're doing as a partnership. A pitcher-catcher relationship's the most fascinating one in baseball for me.
Can I just jump in here? Do you think,
sure,
do you foresee a future in where analytics takes over the game to a point where pitch calling and sequencing is being done by a algorithm
that team
is
of guy on headphones? Yeah,
like relayed to the catcher via headset. I mean, you know, I never would have thought I'd see the day where the outfielders will be checking their cue cards between every at bat, yeah, to see where am I supposed to stand for this guy, right? But
yeah,
I don't think anytime soon, but 10, 15 years from now, do you think that's the direction we're maybe heading, and take that skill out of the catcher's hands, and now we just have to worry about a guy that can hit?
Yeah, there's a lot there. And the first thing when you reference that, I think I had a son that played college baseball. I remember first watching him play college baseball, and I remember the coach from the dugout yelling out to the catcher and giving him numbers for pitches. And I'm thinking, he's calling all the pitches. His first, like, I'm watching this going years back now. And I was like, wow, that's kind of interesting, because that's one thing I learned in the minor leagues was how to call a game. And mm-hmm. they forced us, Rick Williams and his staff, and Louis Pujols was my catching coordinator. They forced us to call a game because that's how you learn. Now, what you're saying is, are we going to get to that? Well, if it's going to be that mapped out, to me, there's no way you can do that or have something like that, because it's being played by human beings. The guy on the mound is a human being who might not have his best slider today. He might have his best slider ever coming out of the bullpen to start the game. And by the second or third inning, he hasn't found it yet. Well, as a catcher, you need to adapt. You need to say, you know what, the curveball might be a better pitch today. He's getting better rotation on it. Or the fastball or the changeup is... you have to adapt on the fly. And that happens throughout the course of a game. So no logarithm knows that, because they're not catching the pitch. There are so many times that I came in from the dugout between innings, and you'll see on TV sometimes, pitching coaches and managers will ask the catcher in the fifth or sixth inning how the pitcher looks. Because you can watch the game, but as a catcher behind the plate, you know exactly what his pitches are doing. You know how mm-hmm. that slider's breaking, or if it's backing up and spinning, or how much life he still has on the fastball. You can watch the hitter swings. So, I mean, the catcher's got the best seat in the house for all of that. So that's why, I mean, as long as the game's going to be played by human beings, we need human beings making those decisions. But I think, you know, where you're going to is, that's a strong word, that analytics word. I mean, we could talk about that for hours. But I think when I hear that word now, I just think information. I think data. And, you know, 30 years ago when I played, we had information and data, but it just wasn't as in-depth as it is now. So when I was a catcher, we would have reports before the game. You know, Joe Kerrigan was my pitching coach in Montreal. I sit with him. Let's say Chris Knappholz was starting tonight, and we know what his strengths and weaknesses are against each hitter. Well, he had a scouting report based on all of that, and we're going to try to execute that scouting report. But you have to be able to deviate mm-hmm. as you go. And I'm going to call my game, and I'm going to deviate as I go if the pitcher's curveball isn't what I thought it was going to be today. You have to be able to adjust and adapt on the fly. And I just, to me, if analytics is information, like we used to have, hey, guy loves swinging at first pitch fastballs, or with two strikes, he can really, he'll chase the breaking ball down and away. We had basic information because most of it was done by scouts with our eyes. But now we have parts of the strike zone where hitter swing planes are. And now that we're, this is analytics to another degree. So to me, it's the same thing. It's just way deeper because of technology. We have all this technology now because Charlie Montoya can go to the guy out of the bullpen because his pitches or his strength, let's say it's a, maybe it's Roman or him. I mean, he's a high leverage guy, but let's say it's a sixth inning. It's a middle type guy. But he might match up with a certain hitter because that hitter's swing plane is here, but can't get to the low pitch or can't get to the high pitch or the up and away pitch, that part of the strike zone he struggles with. All of this information has shown, and it shows batting averages in every little part of the zone. So we pitchers are going to try to attack those zones, and some pitchers naturally might do that with the stuff that they throw. So what I'm saying is analytics is, it shouldn't be a negative connotation. It is, because it's gone like crazily through the roof, and now we're using it to just say, you can't pitch three times through the batting order. You're gone. Well, I understand the third time through the batting order is a thing. Look at the numbers. They tell a story. But don't tell me that when Jose Barrios is going back out for the sixth inning and they've got one hit off and they're not touching him. And if he goes out there and gets hit, I get it. Use your eyes. If he gives up a couple hard hit balls, that's fine. But you just have to remember, the guy coming in from the bullpen is not always going to be better. We see guys come in, do well. We see guys come in and explode. And I've always said on that topic, and this kind of has a lot to do with analytics, because that's what pitching decisions are often made of. The right decision is the one that works. Charlie, you go to the bullpen and the guy gets the job done, that interview after the game will be much easier.
Brilliant. Absolutely.
Brilliant. Yeah.
Okay, we're going to take a left turn here, Joe. I know that the MLB finally put an end to the Montreal-Tampa Bay half-breed idea. What are your thoughts on baseball in Montreal? Do you think it's a legit MLB market, and should it get another kick at the can? And I asked that question in that way because we had Anthony Telford on the cast a few times, and he loved Montreal. Really. He's like, the whole reason I still get an MLB pension is because Montreal was there for me. But he was saying, as much as he does love Montreal, that they have lost their opportunity to host a major league team. He feels it's a one strike and you're out type of idea. Where are you at on that? And do you think that Montreal could host another MLB team?
I certainly agree with that sentiment. Like any sport, when a city loses a team because it wasn't supporting it, then why would you go back there? But I think times change, and ultimately it comes down to money. We know that. So the city would have to be proven ready, new stadium, finance the whole bin. That's way above my pay grade. But if you can do that, to say that it's supported and we're ready for that, then I think it should be a viable option. But I'm sure Nashville is going to be an option too. And I'm sure, I think first and foremost, Oakland and Tampa Bay have to get their things figured out. Because if they, if one or both don't figure things out, you get two possible cities. That's before expansion. That's just moving. Before you, you know, the commissioner's talked, the league has talked about trying to get to 32 teams at some point to try to even things out. So do I think they have a chance yet? Yeah. When I heard that Montreal Tampa split stuff,
right?
I honestly rolled my eyes and thought it was comical for a while until I kept reading and I'm like, is this thing really, like, is this got a possibility of happening? Because the more
I think it's why MLB finally put an end to it. It's like, they were like, they're like, we're going to let you do this as leverage for a while, but now that this fake idea is becoming a real one, absolutely not.
Yeah, and I'm not close to that situation, but when I first heard it, to me, I just thought it was political posturing by Tampa to say, hey, let's put some heat on here on the city here to build a stadium and see what's going on. And then now it's, you know, it is where it is, and we'll see where it goes. But I do think that there are certainly other cities out there. And I think Montreal should be one of those cities considered. And then when that time comes, you weigh everything. And maybe part of weighing it is that they had a team and didn't support it. I don't know how that goes down when they ultimately decide. But you're talking about two cities that are kind of struggling. I mean, we're hearing Oakland could be in Las Vegas following their football team. Who knows? But sort that out first. And then down the road, are they thinking still of adding two more teams? I don't doubt it. It would make a lot of sense to have an even number of teams and 16 in each league. And But
this isn't even new, right? Like, the truth is, Joe, Yeah, like we could have had this talk about Oakland and Tampa Bay in 2016, right?
It's like every year, every winter we talk about this.
Yeah. Yeah, okay, so number one, know you're Canadian. You've come up the Canadian baseball route, and it is a tight-knit group. And I've always kind of been impressed with how supportive Canadian baseball, the scene is to its players and its coaches, and everyone kind of has each other's back. How much have you seen Canadian baseball progress since you made your way up through the ranks in the 80s and early 90s? And what is your opinion in what, in your opinion, is the biggest improvement in baseball development in the country since you were playing?
Well, this is an easy one, guys, because I lived it. And when I was 18 years old, I played on what is now called the junior national team. We called it the youth team back then, I believe. So I was 17, 18, got asked to come to the tryouts. I think we held them in Toronto for maybe a week. Kids from all over the country must have been invited, and there are these week-long tryouts, and at the end of the week, they picked the team. But the interesting thing is, it was in the summer, and when they picked the team, we went to the World Tournament. That was it. That's what we did. You gathered for a week, tryout camp, they picked the team, and we went. My year was 1985, and we went to Albany, New York. That's where the World Tournament was. We didn't do real well there, but what a phenomenal experience. Now, fast forward 85, yeah, 20, 30 years, my son, who played on the junior national team, Team Canada, they've gone to spring training facilities in Florida. They play like the spring training pro teams. Like they'll go down and play the New York Mets rookie ball team. This is when they're 18 years old. They'll get waxed. They got beat up. I went to watch some of those games, but this is what they do. The tremendous exposure. They play high level college teams. He went to a qualifier in Colombia playing on the world stage. He played in the world championships in Seoul in South Korea. I mean, what this team does now, and I'm referring to the junior national team of Team Canada that Greg Hamilton runs, it's unbelievable. These kids at 17 and 18 years old are playing on a world stage multiple times a year. Like they're playing against the top competition three and four and five times a year. So that's how far it has come. And that's just a tip of the cap to Baseball Canada and what they've done in terms of developing talent in this country. Now, every kid, of course, that plays baseball that wants to play for Team Canada, it's not easy. And I'm sure the selections aren't easy. But the ones that do get that opportunity, even if it's for one camp, sometimes you get invited to one camp, you don't get invited back. I mean, it's not easy. You have to be one of the best in the country. But it's a tremendous experience, but I can see firsthand from what I did when I was 18, then what my son got to do as an 18-year-old and how it prepared him for his college career and ultimately a professional career in the minor leagues. He got drafted by the Oakland A's. So playing on the world stage like that was just the best preparation possible. You take your licks. Let me tell you, we saw them get killed by some college teams and by some pro teams down spring training, instruction league teams or whatever. But you're constantly seeing good pitching. You're constantly seeing guys throwing 95. He got to college finally got to the point, or when he got to pro ball, he saw 95. He's like, I've seen this before. We've seen this before. Like this, it wasn't new. And I can just imagine if the program was the way it was when I came up now, because now you go to one tournament. And then if you are good enough to go to college or end up playing pro, the first guy you saw throwing 95, 97, which a lot of people do now, it would have been crazy. So, yeah, tremendous preparation on the world stage for these kids, and that's where Team Canada has come in several years.
Just the opportunity to get those experiences are now prevalent, you know?
Yeah, it's a wonderful program, and it's a great opportunity for young kids in our country. And I think it's reflective in all the kids and Canadians you're seeing, not just in the big leagues, but playing professionally.
Yeah. So, Joe, we really appreciate your time. Obviously, I could talk baseball with you all day here, but we don't want to keep you too long. So I'm going to ask you one last question. We'll flip to Adam to get to some listener questions, and we'll wrap this up for you. I know you touched on the fact that your major league career was based on how defensively sound you were as a catcher, but you do have one dinger, and I'm curious. I'm curious what that experience was like to hit one out in a major league stadium, and do you have the ball?
I have the ball.
Got the ball.
My first major league home run, it was at Tiger Stadium, and it was off ironically off Jeff Facero, former Expos pitcher, former teammate of mine.
Nice.
And I'm sure to this day he's saying, I can't believe I gave up a home run to Settle. He couldn't hit a lick. I also have the first my first hit, which was off Frank Tanana at the Big O in Montreal. So I did keep those two balls. But yeah, Tiger Stadium, I still live in Windsor, Ontario, grew up across the river from Detroit, and my older brothers used to take us to Tigers games all the time, numerous Tigers games as a kid at Tiger Stadium. So when I signed there and got to play there, I mean, beyond a dream come true.
Cool.
So yeah. To talk about my only major league home run, but there's an interesting story too, as great as it was playing for the Tigers and being in Tiger Stadium for it, it was against the Mariners. And in Detroit, if you remember the old Tiger Stadium, it hit off the facade of the upper deck in right center field and bounced back onto the field. Well, the Mariners center fielder was Ken Griffey Jr. He picked the ball up and he just threw it back up into the bleachers. Now, usually a first major league hit, first major league home run, your team, your staff try to get the ball for you. Well, apparently one of our staff members went to get the ball from that fan. Well, the person wouldn't give the ball back because it was thrown to them by Ken Griffey Jr. So he's trying to negotiate, saying, look, we'll get you another ball. We'll get you whatever you want, a bat or something. But it's his first major league home run. The person wouldn't give it up. So long story short, apparently they did some negotiating, or Griffey got, I don't know if he signed a ball and a bat or a ball or a bat, did something to get that person to give the ball up. So the person
Griffey
got something else.
Griffey had your back. I love it.
To this day, so cool. I have never seen the man to thank him. So someday I'm going to run into Ken Griffey Jr. and thank him, because now I've got the baseball.
That's awesome.
Well, you've got a great talking point for Jr. then. That's amazing.
That's it.
You're so far ahead of most of us.
Exactly.
All right. We'll go to listener questions here. I know we'll get crap on our YouTube comments if we don't get to some of these quickly here. So
no problem.
We'll go to Adam and let you go.
All right, so first one comes from Jessica. She says, this is a funny one. Does Joey Votto have a realistic shot at the Hall of Fame? And Adam still holds a grudge against Votto for his comments about Canada a few years ago. Is it time to forgive him and embrace Joey Votto as a Canadian superstar? Or is Adam right to still be upset about it?
Get over it, Adam.
Okay.
Time to move on.
Thank you, Joe.
Jessica, time to move on. Tell him that yourself, too. Yeah, listen, Joey Votto's quite a personality. I met him once when Cincinnati was in Montreal for one of those preseason games with the Blue Jays a few years back. Don't really know him. I know he's been around our studio with Jamie and our guys, so they know him a little bit better. He's a quirky guy, funny guy that way. So I'm sure whatever he said, I can forgive him of that and move on. And the Hall of Fame thing, my goodness, he's certainly building a pretty nice resume. I have to crunch all the numbers, but wow, what a hitter. And it'd be nice to see him finish strong. I know this game doesn't get easier as you
know. No, it doesn't. Not at 38, but hopefully. You know,
Father Time's undefeated, but, you know, Tom Brady's done pretty well, so maybe Joey can finish strong, so to speak.
Yeah.
All right. Next one comes from Lionheart70 on YouTube. Just want your quick thoughts on robo-umps.
Don't even.
Not a fan.
Don't like it. Don't like it at all. And it goes back to one of the comments I made earlier about this game again. And I get why people want them. We watch games and umpires miss calls. I do get that. I'm okay when the game's not perfect. I'm okay when it's played by humans. And to me, this is probably a biased opinion because I'm a former catcher that, behind the plate, I talked about a pitcher-catcher relationship earlier. The umpire-catcher relationship is a huge one. And I think it's an important one. I love the fact that, I'm not saying that you can schmooze umpires and get calls, but I love the fact that good receivers, and I say catchers that receive the ball well, they do a good job and give the umpire a good look and all, get rewarded. You know, we talked about those framing metrics. I think there are a lot of holes in those numbers, to be honest with you. But I do think a catcher that is a good receiver back there is going to get more calls generally, and he should be rewarded for that ability. Mm-hmm. I think what happens, it's almost like when they took away the slide at second base, the double play, right, where you can't take out the middle infielder now. Now, I'm not for people getting hurt over there and runners trying to hurt guys, but what I am for is a good hard slide, because there are some middle infielders that turn that double play better than others. And I think they should be rewarded for that. Or the ones that aren't as good should be almost punished by not turning a double play. So the ones that do it well should be able to get that extra out of that double play. So I like that rule. And to me, it's easy. If you purposely take somebody out and break somebody's leg, it's easy. Suspend the guy for 25 games and say, see you later. But I mean, a couple guys get hurt and all of a sudden we're changing rules. So I didn't like that. And that's why I think that human element is so important. It's hard because it's all over our TV screens. The box is on the screen. I really wish they'd take that stuff off the screen.
I was just
going
to say, that box has changed the way I watch the game.
Like, yeah. And is the box accurate? Probably pretty accurate, of course. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not exact because it's on a screen, right? Mm-hmm. There's no way you can make it exact. The hitters, the height, until they have sensors on hitters' bodies, I'm not sure you can get the height of each hitter because everything's different. Mm-hmm. The width, for sure. I mean, obviously, you can have lasers or whatever on the sides of the plate. But I just think it's an awful lot. And to me, I can live with that stuff. And I hear, you know, Jamie and I, we go through these games and people tell me on Twitter, I haven't heard too many fans complain when Blue Jays get calls. It's always when calls go against and Grichuk gets rung up
how that is.
Off the plate. Meanwhile, Barrios was just out there and got two pitches off plate. And I know it doesn't always equate, but my point is, never mind all this tit for tat stuff. Mm-hmm. Just play the game and let the umpires umpire and know they're not perfect. And oh, well, I'm okay with that. I'm okay with an imperfect game. And that's probably the way I feel the way I do, because I do think catchers can have an advantage if you're a good receiver back there.
My favorite thing right now that analytically has made fans even more irate and crazy after games where maybe the calls weren't perfect is the analytic they've done where they put all of the mistakes together and they try and give it a run value. And then you just go on Twitter and you just see people losing their mind over this 1.2 runs that the umpires cost them. And it's just like, it is 162 games. Like, I hate to break it to you, it's probably going to even out.
You know, and on that topic, I hope you got an extra minute here. Let's talk about the framing metrics. And the reason I've mentioned it a few times, because I did something this year and I contacted somebody from MLB because I said, my point was this. If, as a catcher, I catch a ball off the outside corner and I do an excellent job of receiving it, the umpire calls it a strike, then I get credit for that. You get a certain credit based on, it's like a sliding scale based on how far outside it was. So if it's a little out and I get the call, I get whatever, say 1 point. If it's further out and I get the call, I get 2 points. And that's not how the system goes, but that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. So to me though, my question to the person was, does it depend what the guy behind you calls? Like if I do an excellent job on the same pitch and he calls it a ball, I don't get credit for that, but it's ultimately up to him. Mm-hmm. And the answer was yes. So that's why those framing metrics, I really have a problem with it. Again, do they give you an idea of how a catcher receives? Probably. But analytics, metrics, these sorts of things that aren't true numbers, like when mm-hmm. you go 3 for 10, your batting average is 300. That's true. Mm-hmm. So, but this other stuff becomes a little more subjective, and then there's point system. And that's why I have a problem with those sorts of things. And that's why if I'm going to be looking to trade for a certain catcher or sign a free agent catcher, I'm not looking there. I'm going to be watching myself. And I think teams have their own proprietary metrics that they use too. So right. I get all that. But just to share with you that those aren't necessarily Bible. That's not necessarily exact.
All right. I got one last question for you. You've been so generous with your time, but I really want to get to this one. This one is from Tamara. She says, "Hey, Joe, so cool to see you on the walk-off. It's great to see so many women being hired into the MLB in some pretty big roles. And at the collegiate level, we're even starting to see some women playing with the boys."
Yeah.
"Is there any chance we one day see a woman playing in the MLB?"
I don't think we can say ever that something's not going to happen, because we're living in a world right now we probably didn't think things were going to happen the way they are. Yeah. With the pandemic, really. I mean, yeah. And it's great to see. And, you know, just recently we saw assistant general manager with the Vancouver Canucks, a woman hired. I mean, this is all great to see, because mm-hmm. when you look at any game, and we're looking at baseball specifically, and if people have knowledge and understanding and leadership skills and know how to handle a team, and there have been some in the minor leagues this year. One was named a manager. And if these are people that know how to manage people, then why can't you manage a baseball team, right? I mean, that part of it is easy. Do you have to play the game and be a former major league baseball player to teach hitting? No. does their experience come in handy? Absolutely, because you can teach me all of the X and O's about anything. But then now if somebody that's actually been in that batter's box or been in the field of play, I'm talking about how pitchers handle you and what he might do with this two-seam fastball that he might swing back front hit, like that kind of stuff is wonderful for the people that played the game. But that doesn't mean you can't teach a skill. That doesn't mean you can't manage a team or be a pitching coach. So absolutely, there's a lot of things I think in this game, and almost like when you talk about the analytics part of the game and using your gut, and I think the best ones are the ones in the middle. Same thing with that, the one with the knowledge and understanding, but then can actually do the skills. If you can marry that and have a collaborative staff, and we're seeing more and more in baseball now, right? We're seeing larger staffs all over the game. The San Francisco Giants were publicized about that this year. We're seeing it more. There's certainly a lot more than when I played, and that's, you know, I know it's a long time ago, but you know, I remember we used to have a manager in the minor leagues, or in the big leagues too, but manager, pitching coach, and like another coach we had in the minor leagues, and a trainer. Like, and the trainer did everything. But now they've got bench coaches, and they've got base coaches, and they've got
performance. Yeah,
everything. Yeah. So, and getting back to the gender thing, so you can't tell me that there are women out there that understand kinesthetic movements and different things, and then managing. So there's so many aspects to a game or an organization that, of course, and we're starting to see that now because we're living in a world that is probably opening their eyes and being a little bit more wide open. So great question, Tamara, and maybe she's one. Maybe she's one that's on the docket.
Love it.
Awesome. Joe, honestly, thank you so much for being so generous with your time. We really appreciate it. All the best to you. We look forward to watching you in 2022, and cheers.
My pleasure, guys. It's always fun talking baseball, especially in the middle of winter. I could talk all day. I do it for a living. Take care. Thanks very much.
Thanks for listening to the Walk Off Podcast with Scott Belford and Adam Mack, with a new episode every Friday.
Oh! With a drive. Cheese and crackers. Shows to pitch to him. Wrong move.
Thanks for listening.